But speaking of the third world and the challenge of the poor may be a way that leads right into the subject for this morning. If I am informed correctly, our professor of missions, Professor Kapitsky, makes it quite clear in his classes to correct the conception of mission work as he describes, characterized by off in some jungle somewhere and somebody sitting in a big kettle being cooked with people with bones through their nose or hair dancing around, and that is the depiction of mission work. But rather, based on the Acts 1:8, the spread of the gospel beginning in Jerusalem and in all Judea and Samaria and unto the ends of the earth. Frequently we forget about the Jerusalem aspect of missions. And that's kind of been the pattern, I think, in the whole question of the urban church and our sociological phenomena of people moving to the suburbs and the church frequently taking its ministry along and sometimes leaving behind those in need of the gospel in the Jerusalem of that situation. And I think it's a combination when one talks about urban ministry that both the challenge of the poor, the need of the gospel, both missions and evangelism and social work. And one parish which has chosen not to do that but to remain is right here in our own city of St. Louis, St. Matthew's, and here to address us on some of the, as I think there was a string of prepositions in the daily announcements, the ins and outs and the what's and wherefores of urban ministry is the pastor of St. Matthew's, Gary Schubert. I knew Gary Schubert off in another incarnation some 30 years ago, I think it was, at Concordia St. Paul, in between his matriculation here and my graduation. They invented the senior college, so that was just about the end of our association, since he's much younger than I am. But it was good to renew an acquaintance, if ever so briefly, some time ago, and meet Gary here at St. Matthew's. And here to present something of the ministry that is taking place at St. Matthew's and the whole picture of the of urban ministry, and also at your request to be enlightened about urban ministry, Pastor Gary Schubert of St. Matthew's. Gary.
Well, as Dean Vogel said, my name is Gary Schubert, and I've got the opportunity to do something that I've been wanting to do for a long time, and that's to come back to the seminary campus after I was graduated and get a chance to talk on a few things here and there. At the same time, I'm doing a class on Thursday nights with Dr. Nasker, so I'm still a student, so I'll try to be careful and watch what I say. I've got a paper that I wrote several years ago on urban ministry, and I can follow that, and I will, but I don't really want this to be a paper reading thing. I would rather just kind of have it give and take, if we can. Let me tell you about some of my past history, first of all. I kind of figure I've been lucky to be in several different places at specific times when things were, well, kind of very important. I graduated in 63 after 2.5 years in upstate New York in a small parish in the Finger Lakes area. I came to Philadelphia. How many of you are acquainted with the East? The East Coast. We got a few folks in here. Okay. I was born in Milwaukee and raised in Minneapolis. I was not aware of what the East was. And sometimes I get the feeling that we here in St. Louis are not always aware of what's going on in the East, or maybe the West too, for that matter, because we tend to think really where we are. I got into a parish in Philadelphia that was basically a white middle-class parish that was located about a mile above the black ghetto line. And Philadelphia is a city of 2 million people, half of whom are black, and a good share of those black people live in the first 3 miles north of downtown. We were located a mile north of that as yet. My ministry there was largely preparing people for change that was certain to come according to the demographic charts of the census and so on in those days. From there, I received a call to a dual parish in Buffalo, New York. And many of you know Buffalo, New York by the weather, but there are many other things involved in Buffalo. That happened to be a dual parish, basically of white folks, separated by about 5 minutes and many other things. Dual parishes are always dual parishes, no matter where they are. We were also about a mile from a very large black settlement. And after 11 years there, we were just starting to make inroads in terms of non-white population being assimilated into the church. I've been here at St. Matthew Lutheran Church for about 2.5 years now. And, well, let's see, let me fill you in a little bit on St. Matthew. St. Matthew is located on the extreme northwest edge of the city. We're about 10 or 15 minutes from the airport, just inside the corner from Jennings and Florissant. Some of you may have heard of Pruitt-Igoe. Pruitt-Igoe was the name given to the high-rise tenements for people that had no place else to go, basically, very low-income people. That was probably one of the more horrendous public housing mistakes made, and we made it between here and downtown. That was raised, cut down some years ago, and when that was cut down, the people were arbitrarily moved from Pruitt-Igoe up into Walnut Park, which is the area that St. Matthew has served. St. Matthew was already in the process of integration. I really don't know the exact statistics, but I would assume that it was not heavily integrated until about 15 years ago, when the demise of Pruitt-Igoe called for some very special steps. My predecessor was there when the church was literally torched. There were some very heavy racial feelings going on in those days, and there were about 3 fires set on the church, and through his good efforts and the efforts of many people here in St. Louis, and the efforts of the congregation who deemed it really important to stay. I think that was when, as Dean Vogel said, the congregation really decided to stay and reach out to the neighborhood. That church was rebuilt, the building, and it has stayed throughout the course of a great deal of racial change. Right now, Walnut Park is about 95% black. It is, well, I kind of call it eclectic ghetto. We have some really neat houses, and we have a lot of vacant lots, and we have a lot of things that are in between. Walnut Park is kind of a symbol of what needs to be done and sometimes what can be done in ministry. During the 70s, St. Matthew became a kind of a pilot project for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. There were some funds poured into a church and community organization. As a result of that, we have a senior citizen center, we have a clinic, we have a new library, and there are some good things that came out of this. The high point of all the work that was done by Lutheran Church Missouri Synod was to be housing. And there was a big change in government funding right about the time that the study came out, and we were left high and dry with no new housing. That's one of the particular interests that we have in reviving right now. So there's a lot of different things going on. I'm going to stop here. and ask you if you got any questions thus far. Just a few sketches in the background. Yeah.
How involved is the church in the needs of the community in a way of how, in other words, how social gospel does it go before we start wondering that we're maybe getting into something that we shouldn't be getting into?
Mm-hmm. The church right now is only involved through me in something called Walnut Park Housing. Okay? And Walnut Park Housing is a very small pilot group setting out to see if it can do some rehabbing bit by bit. The needs are there. What we'd also like to do is see if we can't get kind of a neighborhood inventory and see where we can go with the needs of the people as expressed. How many of you here look forward to a ministry in an urban church as opposed to rural or suburban? Okay, just a couple. Phew. All right. I think statistically there will probably be more people into the urban church than we just saw hands. Why? What's going on with urban churches? Is there a need for such a classification? What I want to do is see if we can't build some interest in the urban church. One of my non-congregational duties back in the Eastern District was to be part of something called planning and strategy for the Mission Board in the Eastern District, of which I was a part back in those days. What we tried to do was to paint a picture of what's going on with the church as a business, as an overall cash flow business. Sorry about that, folks, but we got to put some of that in with the theology, too.
If you have trouble with my sketches, let me know. We'll try to swing it on. Basically, what you've had is city churches being the feeders. Into a district or into other churches that they alone sponsored, which in turn became feeders to build other churches. From there on, we were able to go out into the suburbs and build even more churches. What's happened to the city churches now? To a large degree. A lot of them are closing down. Okay. What happened to a lot of the members from the city churches?
They moved to the suburbs.
They've gone out into these churches. What's going on with the city churches? Okay, the neighborhood is changing, the whole thing is changing, and now you're getting into a minus situation in terms of dollars. You don't have to be in the parish long to figure out that dollars are important too. And if you forget that, there's other people around to let you know that. Okay? Ideally, what we need to do is to reverse some of the funds from going always out here back into the city. And right now the big question is how and to what avail and what are the checkpoints of the ministry here. Urban ministry is really in a state of
experimentation. I don't know that anybody really has the key to a totally successful ministry in the city. And if you do 1 year, it may not be successful the next year. So it's always a ministry of change. Something that you can really have a lot of fun with, as a matter of fact. The church at large still has to figure out what to do with the city church. And I don't know that we have figured that out. Our city church is important. Our city is important. All those are things that need to be figured out. Yes, sir.
Looking at some areas in Chicago, just east of River Forest, it would look like where the whites moved out, the blacks moved in, and as the blacks have moved out, the Hispanics moved in, and then perhaps in some areas as the Hispanics move on, the Vietnamese are moving in, that those churches are for a long time going to be surrounded by a very poor part of our society. And maybe we need to look at getting rid of these big, beautiful, expensive churches and look at smaller entities that can, in fact, be supported by what for maybe 50 or 75 years is going to be a very poor part of our economic structure.
Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, Synod is getting into the idea of storefront churches right now, which is something that has been at least architecturally abhorrent for a long time, but something that is financially certainly a lot more possible. You know, St. Matthew is a really workable parish. We have a workable building and a workable school. And yet, if God doesn't give us much warm weather during the winter, it costs us about $1,000 a month to heat each building. And those are just figures that you've got to work with. But that's part of it. Yes?
Mm-hmm. But are you involved in this, I forget what it's called, this plan, the Three Point Parish? Or?
No, I understand that it's happening in the north side. By some weird quirk of ecclesiastical fate, we are hooked up with the North Florissant Circuit. So we are the city most part of that circuit. But I am really looking to be lined in with the city, because we are city, and we see a lot of the city happening. I should tell you, too, that we have a large drawer in our church filled with transfers out, and that contains about 1,000 cards. And in the upper drawer from there, we have about 80 to 100 white people and about 300 or 400 black people who are members now. We have a parochial school of 112 right now. I was hoping our principal would be able to come by. I guess he didn't make it. We're having Martin Luther King Day at chapel today, so that was an extra special event for him. Victor Belton was our vicar last year, and he's hiding back by the door. And we have a vicar from the other seminary this year. Yes, sir?
Two questions. We spoke at our meeting of the presidents the last couple of days of all of our colleges and seminaries about the need for more black recruitment of black pastors, and I think there's nothing in either seminary is there anyone in the first year class this year, if I'm correct.
I think so.
How do you see the advantages or disadvantages of you as a white pastor being in an area that is 95% black?
Mm-hmm.
One question. The second has to do with planning. You mentioned nobody has the key to urban ministries. What is being done, or what do you envision could be done more by way of intercongregational planning? Those congregations that, like yourself, are in similar situations in the same way. So what is done church-wise, school-wise, and so forth in terms of joint strategy?
Mm-hmm. Okay, question number one, I would probably want to be replaced by a black person. I think that is important. I think that folks should be indigenous. I find that the black congregation is very open and receiving to me, however, and they're not making any big bones about the fact that I'm different from them. So that's one part of it. In terms of planning, it seems to me that it's turning around kind of a dinosaur. I hate to use pejorative terms, but it's kind of like that. I can remember going into a church executive and saying that we ought to really take some, I don't know, $40,000 or $50,000 from a district budget and put it into one or two inner city parishes just as a kind of research and development fund to see, and dollars don't do it all, but to see if we can't do some turnaround with some of the churches that we have. I think I'd estimated that in the Eastern District alone we had, oh gosh, several millions of dollars worth of churches in the cities, Pittsburgh, Buffalo, Rochester, some Philadelphia, some of these. And in case you don't know it, when you sell a church, you get 10 cents on the dollar. So roughly that's about what the return is. And I put that into financial terms because that's board of directors talk. And I think that board of directors understand profit and loss a lot better when you start talking in terms of dollars and cents and where things are. We stand to lose many millions of dollars if we don't do something about a turnaround. And the reply that I got was that we couldn't afford research and development. And that's kind of a stalemate because I felt that we couldn't afford not to really turn things around. There's nothing further. Let me launch into a little bit of this. You may find it a little bit dated and a little bit geographified. This is from the Northeast. I can remember a friend and classmate lecturing to a group of church women saying, ministry is the same wherever you are, in the urban, the suburban, or the rural church. Now, he was an authority. He had been the talented, sensitive assistant pastor in an affluent suburban congregation complete with day school, large parking lot, staff, and building program. He left there to become the pastor to people of an urban church in the Brownsville section of New York City, just a small step removed from Bedford-Stuyvesant, a real Hell's Kitchen. And then the lecturer went on to say he had received a vision from God showing him exactly and precisely into what direction his congregation should be going. He didn't remain there very long. Another acquaintance of mine spent his entire ministry in one urban parish, starting as assistant and moving up to pastor when his bishop retired. The young pastor went downhill with the congregation and the neighborhood, finally drowning his sorrows in alcohol, a broken man in a broken church, at a time when all of his instincts said he should have reached the point of graceful retirement. I'm certain that such mishaps can and do occur in other churches, but I'm also certain that some of the problems peculiar to urban ministry lead a proportionately greater share of full-time church workers into the valley of despair. And it's difficult to minister effectively when you're down there. What are some of the problems peculiar to the urban church? Primarily, they are those associated with the urban area in which the church is located. Change is a basic problem. As the city goes, so goes the city church, we might say. And these days, most cities are not doing very well, particularly cities of the industrial Northeast. Despite image-polishing efforts of public relations agencies, urban America is not the testimony to industrial and technological success that it once was. In many instances, our greater cities are still nice places to visit, but people with the option don't want to live there. The vast population increases of major metropolitan corridors projected in the 50s and 60s have come close to materializing. But like a person whose growth glands have gone awry, the larger they become, the weaker the heart and the internal organs become. Growth of the extremities drains off the life of the inner body. Cities are changing externally. Suburbs are annexing more and more land area. Desert and farmland are converted to asphalt and concrete. But more than that, suburban shopping centers are springing up and enlarging. Business corporations are locating well-groomed, expensive headquarters and factories farther out, often at the expense of their original buildings within the core of the city. Arterial expressways, once heralded as a wonderful way to get people to the city quickly, have been found to go both directions, and the heaviest traffic goes out. Once the scene of action, more and more cities are becoming the scene of reaction, urban renewal programs notwithstanding. Now, the biggest change in our cities is in the people. Change in numbers, change in lifestyle, change in attitudes, change. The only major cities to register population gains in recent years are cities that have enlarged their borders to include more populous suburbs. The core cities are falling victim to a mass exodus of people. Call it white flight, call it upward mobility, it is flight, the leaking of the lifeblood of our cities. Cities are not just land areas, they're people. And the people are leaving. And that's the biggest change of our cities. There are many and various plans to reorganize, revitalize, and repopulate our cities. So far, no plan appears to be working. Let me just insert here that I see some good things going on in St. Louis in terms of redevelopment. However, I think that urban redevelopment, at least in terms of government funding, has really peaked. So we are in danger of losing ground from what we have right here in this city. And I don't know that people in the Midwest realize how very affluent the Midwest is. One of my white members back in Buffalo worked for one of the major steel companies. Buffalo was built on the economy of steel and trains and cars. And none of them have been doing very well lately. There was one time when he got down to his last $50 credit on MasterCard. Now, he's one of the middle-class folks who's just not used to the whole idea of how to work with the system. So there's a lot more poverty than you really see here out east. Now, what happens to the people who remain in our cities? What happens to the people who don't have the option of moving to the success image of the suburbs or beyond? Stayers become the urban people of today. If the image of success is a home in the suburbs, for the moment it would seem to be a primary image, then a home in the city looms as the image of failure. And for many, the image holds up. Many city dwellers, most city dwellers, are not in the city by choice. They're trapped, and they can't move out. How many upwardly mobile, successful, middle and higher income people do you know who remain in the city? These are the lifeblood of any corporation, institution, or city. And some few do remain by choice, but that's their option. Many people in the city do not have the option. They are literally trapped. And who are the people of our cities? The elderly inhabit our cities in great numbers. Most are on fixed incomes or small pensions. These folks can be found almost anywhere in government-subsidized housing for the elderly, in earlier government post-ghetto housing, in decaying ethnic neighborhoods, in the outer fringe of the core city, in apartments, sometimes in decrepit apartments, and on street corners with no place to go. The urban elderly are often frightened and confused. Most of them grew up at a time when families seldom moved from the homestead. Anticipating a sense of security for their old age, the urban elderly tend to be disheartened and angry about their once sufficient income and its nagging failure to provide even the bare necessities of life. Despite many government programs to assist the elderly, it's still rather common to find elderly people, particularly those who live alone, sliding toward the situation in which one of the elderly women of my parish landed. A proud, self-sufficient woman, she found herself unable to cope with the steep increase of her household gas heating bills. Her social security and rental income of under $200 a month, sufficient for many years, did not jibe with monthly gas bills that suddenly kited to over $100. With a value system that said no matter how poor you are, you always pay your bills, her mind boggled at trying to cope with this unbelievable basic expense. When visited by a neighbor, she was existing wretchedly on cold food in a cold house with several months' gas bills and service cutoff warning notices from the gas company stacked up on her kitchen shelf. I'm convinced that her inability to cope with the situation pushed her into a state of premature senility from which she never emerged. So she died really pretty well out of her head in a retirement area home, a home in the area. Social ministry has kind of a bad ring to it for Missouri Synod, and yet it seems to me that the core of ministry for people in the city is to become somewhat of an advocate, to become somewhat of a helper to people who have no other help, an interpretation of the gospel, if you will. But it happens. Our last recorded months in St. Matthew of feeding people included 515 families that we were feeding, helping feed, emergency food. That's not the total ministry, but it's a have-to ministry. If we do not help people, where do they get their help from? Same as this lady here. Where does she go if we do not try to provide some advocacy with some of the utilities, if we do not adopt some of the social ministry standards? Many an elderly city dweller has grown up with a value system that has become increasingly anachronistic. Raised to believe in the solidity of the nuclear family, the urban elderly all often find their support system of children and grandchildren, brothers and sisters, lifelong friends, their very homes, gone. Many people have become so used to changing locations that they think nothing of leaving the ancestral home for another home anywhere in the world. And for the elderly, particularly the urban elderly, this is not true. The casual uprooting of their families represents a basic assault on their values. Change in a neighborhood, racial, social, visual, by urban redevelopment projects, causes concomitant change within the elderly urban dweller. He becomes confused, faced with impenetrable forces and conditions over which he, in his own estimation, has no control. "You can't fight City Hall" becomes a sad, but altogether truthful new value, clashing with his lifelong value system. The urban elderly can become prisoners in their own homes, afraid to venture into the once familiar neighborhood where lifelong friends and neighbors with more mobility have been replaced with new and unfamiliar people. Familiar stores have often closed, ultimately because of more successful stores grouped in suburban malls. During a time of spiraling real estate values, the urban elderly are surprised and chagrined to find that their own city house is worth little or nothing. What was once an altogether acceptable home and neighborhood has become undesirable. That's the elderly. The plight of middle-aged people within the city is even more frustrating than that of the elderly. Raised on the values of television and other media to become discontent with life in low-status neighborhoods, many younger families have had their dreams crushed. Some have tried to move out of the city and failed. Not everyone is equipped financially to attain the coveted suburban dwelling. Second best, and often much less than that, housing and accompanying feelings of failure that accrue lead to hostility and suspicion. Shades of paranoia haunt most of those middle-aged who feel thwarted in self-betterment. They want better jobs, more income, better schools for their children. Caught in the web of comparatively menial jobs, making improvements on a devaluating home and arguing against the monumental power of the school system, they're often forced to settle for television and beer. The school system is the unwitting helper that keeps grinding out ill-taught pupils who carry on the chain of urban people inadequately equipped to escape the life of anonymous mediocrity that they have learned to expect and accept. For those exceptional people who arrive at an understanding of their place in the urban scene and want to do something about it, the temptations to give up are many. Those who genuinely want to upgrade their own homes and their neighborhoods are greeted with apathy, or the shaking of neighboring heads reveals an attitude of disbelief that people can actually improve even their own little corner of the city. The avenues of local politics and citizens' gatherings are no longer viable ways of changing structures perceived as damaging to the individual neighborhood or neighborhood individuals. When people rise up to challenge the system, they're tranquilized by endless bureaucratic meetings and solution-promising programs that somehow dissipate in the systematic realms of politics and commercial corporations. Alongside these powers perceived as institutional giants, individuals feel powerless, rejected, and angry. When a person is convinced by institutional judgments that his values, hopes, and dreams are out of step with his surroundings and doomed to failure, he's inclined to fall into a mood of acceptance and passivity. But seeds of resentment remain to spring up weed-like in all areas of life. And the children of these middle-aged parents, the urban youth, are the most active and acted upon people in the city. Inclined to be active even where their parents are passive, many urban youth see their activity and potential run aground in several significant ways. As their parents are stratified and classified by their socioeconomic status, so the children mirror and magnify the feelings of their families. The fear and confusion of the elderly filter down through the parents to the children. The children have neither the outdated value system of the elderly nor the ideals of self-improvement of the middle-aged. The young people become an entity unto themselves, a peer group spawned by the alienation and negative feelings of families to which they respond without understanding. Youngsters learn from their environment. What do they learn from the city? They learn the basics of survival, how to get along. With variations, most children find that the ways to get along with their families is to avoid them. Parents who are frustrated and angry are not the best parents, not models of accepting love. Searching for acceptance and approval, city children turn to their peer group. The peer group is security. The peer group is acceptance. And yet the peer group is usually trouble. The peer group often becomes a gang. These are the people of the city. There are variations from neighborhood to neighborhood, from socioeconomic group to socioeconomic group. In every city, there are core areas and fringe areas, ethnic areas, elite areas. Each has its own rules, its own boundaries, but the pressures are identical, if varying in intensity. I'm going to pause here for a minute, too. The people of the city. Are they different from people anywhere? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. What's often different about people who are in the city?
The thing that seems most apparent for a person who has come from the suburbs is that one gets the feeling that their whole value system is completely different than ours. And I don't know if it's justified or not, but one seems to say that that's the root of the problem.
Okay, their value system, can you clarify that? Or an example?
The middle class work ethic was to work hard, save money, improve your home, put your kids through college. Mm-hmm. That's the thing I grew up with. Mm-hmm. That's what my parents did. When you, looking at the inner city from our perspective, on the outside looking in, puzzled, trying to understand it, one seems to not see improvement in a home, not stay. Buying things, you've heard it again and again. Why do they have such a big car? We don't eat steaks very often, yet I see them buying steaks. Is it the clash of values? if we say last live, they're not going anywhere. They don't understand what it means to just work hard.
Mm-hmm.
One example. How do you deal with that if you were a middle class white thinking about Sunday perhaps getting placed in an urban setting? Your first reaction is see if you can make them middle class.
Mm-hmm.
Is that valid, or do we sort of slap ourselves in the hand and say don't be so colloquial? But in reality, it's the truth. I don't know how you look at it.
Is middle class ethic and the Protestant ethic the same? I want to touch on that in a little bit, but we'll get back. Yeah.
This past year on my vicarage, I had a chance of working with a lot of youths who were from the inner city. I worked at a job corps.
Mm-hmm.
And basically their whole ethic was to, you know, to get for myself, you know, survival, and that's good enough.
Mm-hmm.
It was really... What I found is that they never had much, and they could never depend on anything. They could never depend on parents, they could never depend on savings or anything. So it was just live for today. And if you could get it by lying, if you could get it by stealing, however you could get it, you know, get it and have it and use it. And then, you know, then wait for tomorrow to see what you do then. And that was their ideas.
Yeah, folks are basically pretty pragmatic. Yeah. And when you're in a survival situation, you tend to become a survivalist. So there's a lot of that going on. Maybe it still remains for the church to help people see that there's more to life than survival. And that's where Christian gospel can come in.
Yes. I just want to add to that, I think Mark pointed to a real need, and that is to establish a foot system.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that I see as a real need, is to establish a real support system where those people who are survivalists can realize, hey, there is somebody I can lean on, the church.
Okay, the trick is to do that without becoming very, very parental, without becoming people who look down their noses at other people. It's not so much providing for people as working with people so that they can establish a sense of their own self-worth and their worth under Christ in the gospel. And to me, that's very fundamental to the whole idea of being a Christian pastor. Yeah.
Earlier in your paper, you mentioned that the presence of the affluent in the city is necessary as sort of a lifeblood, and that as with white flight, that was being drained away.
Well, historically, that's kind of the way it's been.
Okay. Yeah. However, it seems that now there seems to be in some areas a trend to move back into urban areas and rehabilitation of urban areas by the affluent, and that seems to just drive out the poor. I mean, the property values go up, and the buildings are revamped, and it doesn't seem to be helping the poor. It seems to just send them to slums and get a better place.
Mm-hmm. What it does do is help the tax base of the city. Basically, that's why there's a lot of redevelopment going on. Here's our current vicar, Marcus Sims, with us now. By the way, welcome, Marcus. And partly that's important because the city needs to have the wherewithal to provide for its people as well.
So what you're saying is that increased tax base is turned around in sort of a trickle-down to help the other poorer?
Somewhat, sure. Why are cities in trouble? Financially. Not only the rip-off of politicians, But the change in the whole tax structure. If you've got the number of vacant lots and vacant blocks out there, they're not going to generate any tax base. So that's why redevelopment is an important thing to have happen. Okay, that's some of the side issues of social gospel. Sure.
What you're saying, but yet there are going to be certain, if the tax base does go up, there are going to be a significant number of displaced people.
Yep.
Where do they go?
Basically, that's why there's a lot of redevelopment going on. Here's our current vicar, Marcus Sims, with us now. By the way, welcome, Marcus. And partly that's important because the city needs to have the wherewithal to provide for its people as well.
So what you're saying is that increased tax base is turned around instead of a trickle down to help the other supporters?
Somewhat. Sure. Why are cities in trouble? Financially. Not only the ripoff of politicians, but the change in the whole tax structure. If you've got the number of vacant lots and vacant blocks out there, they're not going to generate any tax base. So that's why redevelopment is an important thing to have happen. Okay, that's some of the side issues of social gospel. Sure.
More to that point, that's a question I had, because I see the validity of what you're saying, but yet there are going to be certain, if the tax base does go up, there are going to be a significant number of displaced people.
Yep.
Where do they go? I guess the recurring problem is that you can look at it, it's going to happen, and we'll have to deal with it just.
Okay. It seems that many city planners look at things in terms of, if these poor people remain here, we are all going to go down the tubes. If these rich people can come back in here, they will save the city by replenishing the tax base. And it seems to me that somewhere in between here, where we view poor people as people, as well as the affluent as people, and an amalgamation, however impossible that may be.
Okay, but what you're describing then is kind of a reversal of the life cycle. Now they're coming back in a little bit, mm-hmm. But what you want to do now is hypothetically to say, stop halfway. We want some fluent people in here, and let's pepper some people in here that throw them in, leave them where they are, leave the poor where they are, and let the more fluent people come and sit in among them. And then we'll have a tax base, but we'll have the poor among them. But yet, this is just a total reversal of the cycle, where the rich will come back into the city, tax base will go up, and all the poor will have to go. And it's just a flip again of the whole cycle. Isn't that what we're dealing with? And it's not going to stop at a halfway. It won't stop at the right point in time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can look at the good while it is balanced, that's fine. But then that just doesn't seem to be the way things work, because where Colonel Fluent go and rehab those buildings, why, then that starts looking pretty good. And white flight or flight or whatever you want to call it, that didn't happen overnight either. That was good.
For sure.
That's mm-hmm. 20-30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just from my perspective. I can see that happening again. Another cycle.
Okay. I see the church having kind of a mediating position in that kind of a situation. Okay? To say that the real people are not just the affluent people, but are all the people. And we need to minister to those who, by any human standards, are poor people, as much or more than we need to minister to and with other people. What happens to a neighborhood when a church moves out? Anybody have any idea? What happens to a neighborhood, an extremely bad neighborhood, when a church finally gives up and moves out? I talked to a man in Brooklyn a few years ago who was a school bus driver. He drove a school bus for handicapped kids. And he said he had been down in the south part of the Bronx, I don't know if any of you know New York City and the Bronx in particular, but I usually say that there are two zoos in the Bronx. The animals that we're used to are in the Bronx Zoo North, and the animals that used to be people are kind of in the Bronx Zoo South. South Bronx is pretty tough stuff. That's where this guy drove his school bus, and he said he had seen the churches move up, and he was witness to many of the synagogues and the churches and the bigger temples that moved out. And as they moved out, things got worse. So that he was driving a school bus through territories where every now and then a couple of these folks would jump on the school bus doors and hammer them open and come in and kill drivers and rape students and nurses and so on. This is what was going on. The church, it seems to me, has a responsibility, even a civic responsibility, if you will, over and above, or over along with the responsibility to Christ, to be part of the neighborhood, that we need to remain where we are. We're kind of the last bastion of some civility and civilization to one another. And that's the mediating influence that hopefully will bring people together.
Mm-hmm. You said a little bit earlier, you were getting some of the questions from the front row there about providing to the people. You said not to do it. The trick was not to do it as a parent.
Not paternalistic. Right.
What do you think that it should be for as a brother? Is that the difference you're making? Or what do you mean by not being a brother?
Yeah, more as a brother. To make sure that things are done fairly, so that people do not become dependent, totally dependent on you as a source. If you really work with counseling people, very often you have to become a parent. And the duty of a parent should really be to foster the children, if you will, to grow up and out of the home. And there has to be some of both. Maybe immediately a parent, but further on to set up a situation where people have, where they're renewed with their own self-worth. Yeah?
Aside from just the day-to-day maintenance of making sure that people have heat in their home and food in their mouth, what do you see as the needs that have to be addressed if you're going to try turning it around ultimately, instead of just trying to put band-aids on things that are really bad, trying to cure it in some way? What do you see as the biggest needs? Is it education? Is it employment?
But, yep. Everything and more, for sure. A large area of ministry is band-aid ministry. And you have to just face that. Sometimes there needs to be band-aids put in. However, you also have to be open to the systems that are around and to try to work with the systems to be kind of advocates for the people who are often being wrecked by the systems. Systems, I'm talking about some of the politics, some of the utility companies, some of the attitudes of people toward one another. There's all kinds of systems that can really keep people down.
Being a field worker, I think Matthew...
Sorry about that, Jim. Yeah, we didn't introduce you.
through some of the things that go on, I think, Matthew, there's excellent opportunities that come from a rural or a small community church, which I'm used to. There's so many more opportunities for ministry along with these things. And, well, take for instance a school, since there aren't that many member families from the old
historic congregation.
The old people of the church not there anymore with kids. A lot of the school is
mostly non-member children.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, that's a wide open field. You can go see them and evangelism there. And also that people that come from the neighborhood to your door for food, clothing, and heat, things like that, there's opportunities there to spread the gospel and walk with some of the principles that you talked about. And, you know, that's wide open here at St. Nancy, and there's only so much a few people can do. And, you know, the other opportunity is training some of your people to handle a lot of the local food.
Mm-hmm.
I think the realities of the placement process, though, indicate that the vast majority of us are going to be placed in either small town or rural or small suburban congregations. The number of us who will actually be placed in inner city congregations is probably fairly small. What would you say to us, how could we as rural or suburban or small town pastors assist the ministry in the inner city? I mean, is there some sort of partnership arrangement that could be facilitated, or team ministry, an urban suburban sharing kind of ministry that could be implemented? How could we help you in doing your ministry?
It, by all means, the sharing is a good thing to have happen. We've had vacation Bible schools in a previous parish of mine where we exchanged with people from a rural parish. So some of the kids from the city got a chance to see a calf being born. And some of the folks from the rural area got a chance to walk downtown and go through a downtown mall and things like this. It seems to me on a larger basis, we're seeing a lot of sensitivity now in Missouri to the difficulties that people are having who own farms, where there's a whole lot of drain of money and so on, and people are folding up and having all kinds of trouble. The whole network from urban to rural is really interdependent, so that while we certainly want to circle in on the difficulties of the rural parish, we should realize that the rural parish also is affected by what goes on in the city, and vice versa, that we are really interdependent, that there is no total isolationist kind of ministry possible even now. Yeah. Well, St. Matthew, at this point, we have an outreach program that tries to work with some of these folks in terms of sports and Bible stuff alongside to try to relate the kids into the church. I think that you also need to work with city agencies involved in these things, and because there's going to be a lot more resources available for you, too, to see if you can constructively channel the energies of folks. You also find that St. Louis, per se, is not a gang city. The East has many more gang cities. Now, where I was in Philadelphia, we didn't have any gangs in that particular area, but we had at any given time about 300 kids on the loose in the neighborhood, and they would form into groups of 30 or more, and they kind of qualified as gangs along the way. Yeah.
I'm wondering if you could just comment on how you see your vision of your own ministry in light of Acts chapter 6, verse 4, which says, "But we will devote ourselves to prayer and to the ministry of the word." And my second question was concerning 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verse 1, which says, "Now concerning the collection of the saints being in Jerusalem."
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to hear your comments on that.
We have already linked up with a couple of parishes who are helping us. We have Salem Blackjack out in the far reaches of Florissant, who comes through with a lot of additional food and toys and sometimes money for us to be able to share with people in the neighborhood. In terms of using prayer and really seeing this as an important part of ministry, for sure, yeah. That's, you don't start a day without it, nor end it without it. Yeah.
Do you think we're really putting a lot of emphasis on that, as our churches, are we really emphasizing the need for that sort of thing in our congregation? Pray for our, the poor congregations in the city congregation, and to help support them.
Yeah, I think that really goes kind of parish by parish. And when all is said and done, I think individual congregations tend to watch out for themselves. They've got a lot of survival instinct, as we were talking about the inner city folks before, are really going to watch out for themselves. And if there's something left over, and sometimes there is, they're going to help some of the other parishes. I don't see us as really wanting subsidy so much as the chance to experiment. So we're talking more like strings away money, you know, things like this, or expertise, really informational gatherings. Seems to me that there should be much more of a link up for folks who are laboring in the city. Yeah.
How does your worship service reflect the culture of the community? Does that change along with the community?
Really very little. We are still a red hymnal church, mostly because we don't want to put the money into the new hymnal. We have a fantastic gospel choir whose leader has been dormant for the last several months, but this is probably one of the biggest aspects of change. Working with the kids in our school and chapel, probably more so. Some of them were surprised to find out that Jesus isn't white, things like this. Maybe you're surprised to find that out. But I said he was really probably all colors together because he was Jewish. Okay. How are we doing for time, Lee?
About 2.5 minutes.
Okay. I've got another half in here on some of the observances that I've had on transitional churches, what happens in here. Let me just try to put in here, and if you've got a question along the way, just stop me short, will you? These are the cities in which the church has historically labored. It has labored well and long. Almost every neighborhood has its massive ecclesiastical buildings, often standing proud in the midst of a once proud, now decaying or replaced parish. These church buildings are the embodiment of the pious dreams and precious dollars of the parishioners who have long ago moved away. The church did a good job. It supplied the ethics, the hope, and the affirmation that its members needed. There's a love affair between the God who liberates and the people he liberates. When the people of the parish become liberated out of the neighborhood, they're reluctant to leave their affirming church. At the same time, there's a love-hate relationship with the church neighborhood, often the place of their birth and growth, but also a symbol of the suffocating frustration from which they have been liberated. Somehow the church that liberated its parishioners becomes imprisoned by the misappropriated love of its members. The liturgy, the Sunday school, the program that was so good for them are still the object of their affection. They're free to enjoy this loving, locked-in fragment of their past to assist them in their newfound status and freedom in the suburbs. If someone from the church neighborhood, someone who took their place in the loved, hated neighborhood, should venture in, they are free to join the church as long as they conform to the desires of the constituent membership. This is the urban church in transition. The transition is basically downward in membership and effectiveness. The children of the liberated members are more mobile and less in love with the old home city church. Family members who demand allegiance to the family church die off. One by one, the props of family, friends, and location are dislodged, and the historical church becomes drained and defeated. churches do not die quickly or easily, but they do die. The massive suburban expansion of the church during the 50s and the 60s was highly visible and touted as the working of the Holy Spirit. The nearly invisible and largely ignored decline of the urban church has never been credited to anyone. Churches, like most institutions, are geared for only one kind of change, steady growth. What happens when the steady growth of years suddenly reverses and the downhill change sets in? Denial, anger, frustration, fear, frenzy, and finally determination result. But seldom is there renewal or revival, certainly not without a conscious redirection of the church's program into the neighborhood. And yet the neighborhood is often the last place the urban church seeks to work in ministry and mission. Much time, energy, and postage are spent in trying to rededicate the relocated members and their children. Transfers and demits are given grudgingly, and when the number of people leaving surpasses the number of people coming into the church, a collective guilt and paranoia grips the people who are left in the urban church. Okay, I think my time is at an end. Would like to ask if there's anything further before I slide out of here. Yes.
Can't just let it pass. Always. My brother, the thing that we want to do to end up in an urban church is love the people. And if you end up coming, going from a rural place to an urban place, the thing you want to do is love the people. And when you love your people and don't love your people with that stuff that you get, which is good for talking to one another, theologically, but love your people with that stuff that's good for showing the concern of Christ. And what that may mean is that you may have to sometimes take off your task and get your answer. That may mean that sometimes you may have to provide transportation for folks who don't have and wouldn't otherwise have transportation. May mean you may have to intervene in some family relationships and take a child to the hospital because the child's mother does not have that much concern for the child. But at the bottom of it, wherever you happen to be, I think the key is going to be love your people. The link between urban and rural is in the preaching of the gospel. The rural pastor has to preach the gospel and say in Christ there's no distinction. So that when that rural man meets that urban man, there's a bond there. And that bond is not in society. That bond is in Christ, or else there is no bond. And I think that gets to Paul's question about also Ralph about where the commonality is. It's in Christ. It's in Christo. And if it's not there, then there is not.
Okay. Thank you.
I want to express my appreciation, Gary, before you run away. I don't think I would describe the presentation as either entertaining or enjoyable, but rather enlightening, disturbing, and stimulating, and I doubt whether you would have it any other way. For that, I appreciate your presence with us this morning. Those of you who totally want to destroy your appetites before lunch, you're certainly welcome to take the rest of the donuts with you and to remember 2 weeks from today, beginning at 10:30, to a degree, maybe picking up somewhere where we leave off, the Day of Theological Reflection, the challenge of the poor to Christians in affluence. Thanks.